There's more mischief, mayhem, and nefarious goings-on in the city of brotherly love than Billy Penn could have ever imagined. We've got it all here on the Twisted Philly Podcast. True crime, haunted history, the coolest and creepiest places to visit. Welcome to Twisted Philly.
Hey, Twisters, what up? I'm Dina Marie, the host of the Twisted Philly Podcast, and today's episode is a little different. Actually, it's a lot different because today, I'm getting all excited now, today I have a very special co-host, which is something I've never had before, and I'm so fucking excited to have someone host with me, especially someone who has become one of my best friends, and I'm looking at her beautiful face right now. Now, I'm not going to say who it is. I'm going to let this guest talk and see if the listeners can figure it out. So, special guest, say something.
I think it's pretty obvious who I am.
Oh, would you like to guess who it is? Have you figured it out? It's Allie from...
Can I guess?
Yo, yeah, you get to guess.
I'm Allie from Insight.
Yay! It's Allie from Insight Podcast. In honor of Allie joining us today, we are not going to be Twisted Philly. We are going to be Twisted Sight. And I have to give Allie credit for that because she came up with that idea and I think it's brilliant. All right, so before I completely lose my shit like an idiot because I'm so happy we're recording together, why don't you take a couple minutes and tell everyone about Insight and where they can find you and anything you want folks to know about your show.
Well, Insight is a weekly true crime podcast. We cover basically everything true crime. So missing persons, unsolved crime, cold cases, forgotten history, some kind of just different mysteries. We try not to be all murder, stabby, stab all the time. You can find us on iTunes, basically anywhere you find podcasts. Our Facebook is Insight, two words. We have the page and a private discussion group. Instagram is at InsightPod. Twitter is at InsightfulPod. And I think that's it.
What I love about your discussion group, besides everything that you guys share about cases that you've covered and what members post about cases that either you've already talked about or cases that they have interest in, is all the Australian animals that people post to that page.
Our group is so cute. It's awesome.
There was a video that got posted just this week of a kangaroo petting a dog. And so everybody really acknowledges your Australian heritage, which I think is so fucking cute.
And the baby wombat.
Oh, the baby wombat. I wish they would stay small like that, like little teeny tiny teacup pigs. But I don't think teacup pigs stay small either. I think they get big too.
When they grow, they're still so cute.
How big do they get? Do you know?
Like, I don't know.
Like a dog, maybe?
Big. No, bigger than a dog.
Yeah, no, that wouldn't
they're
work
massive.
In my house.
Big and fat and lazy, and I just want to be a wombat.
It sounds like one of my dogs, big and fat and lazy. So Allie and I have been talking for a little while about recording together, and there was an episode that I had been working on, and I shared the topic with Allie, and she really liked it, and she had a great story of her own, similar topic, so the timing was sort of perfect. And, you know, obviously we both enjoy true crime. Allie's show is all true crime. My show is heavy true crime. We're both moms, and yes. American Mother's Day was just last week. Did you guys have Mother's Day last week, too, or is it a different
same
time?
Same day.
Okay, same day. So Universal Mother's Day was last week, and I was sick. I had no voice. In honor of Mother's Day, we are doing a belated true crime show, and we are talking about kids who kill. Yeah, because that's a happy topic for Mother's Day. But it's definitely twisted. So I had messaged Allie earlier this week to say, okay, which one of us gets to go first? And she said she really didn't care. So I'm going to ask her again, do you want me to go first? Do you want to go first?
I'll go first.
Okay, let's give Allie some sisterly affection. She is our guest, and Allie, the mic is yours.
Thank you. So my story, when I was researching it, there is definitely shades of the more recent Slenderman stabbing that happened in the US. Unfortunately, in this case, the victim didn't survive, but the themes are definitely similar in that there seems to be serious mental health issues at play, possibly brought on by significant drug use, and there's also an unhealthy codependent relationship at play. But this is the story of three, I guess you can call somewhat average 16-year-old girls And they lived in the small mining town of Collie, which is in southwest Western Australia. And besides the victim's name, the other names that I will mention in this story, they have been changed because we're talking about miners here. These three girls were friends. We have two best friends, Julie and Brittany. They were such good friends, they would call each other their twin, which made sense because they looked similar, they were similar height and build, and they were only born 4 days apart, so they could easily be taken as sisters. Both had difficult and troubled childhoods. Brittany's mother was a single mother from the time she was three, and she worked long hours, so Brittany was alone a lot of the time. Julie's father died of a drug overdose when she was four, and then her mother was killed in a car accident when she was 12. So Julie would bounce around from her stepfather's house to friends' houses to relatives' houses. She didn't last very long at any one place because there were behavioural issues and they couldn't manage her.
So she didn't get put in foster care or anything. It was just different family members were trying to take care of her and it just wasn't working out.
Exactly. And that's kind of the preferred method over here.
Okay.
So in December of 2003, Brittany begs her mother to let Julie move in with them, which her mother wasn't a fan of, but she eventually gives in. And things go great for a while, but it isn't long before Brittany's mum comes home from work, and there might be something like 15 kids there playing loud music and taking drugs and drinking.
Oh, hell no.
And there is one occasion where the two girls were seen in the house. They were throwing live matches around the house.
Oh, my God. Like, that's exactly. A really bad idea.
And then by mid-2004, Brittany had started self-harming, and Julie had moved on by this time. She was living at a farm owned by a family friend of hers, and not long after she moved out, she attempted suicide. And this was all blamed on her separation from Brittany. And then she basically just stopped going to school. She stopped contacting other family members. She kind of isolated herself. And then there were rumours that Brittany and Julie were going to commit suicide together by jumping off the biggest building in Collie. Brittany's mother tried to keep a tighter leash on her, but with her work hours, she was working long days, and she had to because she was the sole income provider. It was hard, if not impossible. So the final straw was in November of 2005 when Brittany came home with a girl she was skipping school with, and she wanted this girl to stay the night. When her mother refused, Brittany ran away from home. Brittany refused to come home, and with all her skipping school, she was placed in state care. And her accommodation, it was a caravan in the front yard with the third girl in this story. So the third girl is another friend of theirs, Eliza Jane Davis, and she actually wasn't quite 16 yet. Her birthday was the following month after the crime happened. But Eliza's story is similar to Brittany and Julie's, as in she had a difficult upbringing and she started experimenting with drugs and she dropped out of school.
Is it easy for kids to get their hands on drugs in that part of Australia? Is it just...
In small country towns, it is easier. Basically, that you don't have anything else to do.
I mean, we see the same thing, I think, over here in the States. People think, oh, the big cities like Philly, New York, D.C., they have a lot of drugs, but, you know, out in this... In the country areas or the rural areas, it's not as much, but you find that it's almost the same, to your point. There's nothing much else to do.
I grew up in a country town, and even though that wasn't my scene, I was a bit of a square. I know a lot of my friends, what they did. So we'll fast forward to January 2006. Julie and Brittany were still in constant contact. They were smoking large amounts of cannabis, and they were taking ecstasy or whatever else they could get their hands on. Neither girl was working or studying, and Brittany's behaviour was becoming increasingly disturbed. I did read there was one occasion where she found a homeless kitten, and when it got sick, she killed it and left it on the kitchen table of the home she was living at the time. And then in April, Julie moved up to Perth, which is 200 kilometres or 125 miles to live with her godmother, and then she moved on to live with her foster brother. But by mid-June, she was back in Collie to go to a party with Brittany and Eliza. That night, Eliza coloured and cut Brittany's hair, and they were doing just typical girly things you do before you go out. And Julie seemed to take offence to this. It was almost like she was jealous because she thought she was being replaced. So this night, we're at June 17, 2006, The girls went to a party where they did take some hardcore drugs. They were taking methamphetamines. They came back to the house Brittany was living at, and around 4 in the morning, Eliza goes to sleep in the spare room and the two other girls sleep in Brittany's room. The following morning, Julie and Brittany wake up before Eliza. They get to talking about Eliza, and according to court transcripts, they just decide to kill her. And this isn't the first time the two girls had discussed killing someone. It was a topic they often spoke about, who they would kill and how they would do it. So with the decision made, in court transcripts, the girls made it seem very spur of the moment, but in reality, it was much more calculated than that. The two girls changed into some old clothes. Brittany went around the house. She gathered up speaker wire, different household chemicals and a flannel, and then they waited. Eliza eventually comes looking for them, and as soon as she has her back turned to them, I think I read that she was reading a high school yearbook, Julie holds the chemical-soaked rag over her mouth while Brittany wraps the wire around Eliza's neck twice. Eliza does struggle. She fights violently for her life, but the two girls overpower her and she dies. Brittany and Julie then drag Eliza's body down the stairs into the cellar. They dig a 40 centimetre deep or 15 inches and they bury her there. Now, there is no reason for them to do this. Eliza didn't provoke them in any way. There was no disagreement. There was no fighting. Yes, all three girls were drug users. They smoked marijuana and methamphetamines the night before, but it wasn't like they were using at the time of the murder, so drug intoxication couldn't be used as an excuse. And the girls did admit that much themselves. They said when they woke up, they felt fine and perfectly normal. So after they bury the body, they gather up Eliza's handbag, clothes and cell phone and they throw them into the local river. They call Eliza's mother and tell her that they don't know where she is. They can't find her. She never came home that night. And they contact the police to report her missing. And they actually go out and help search for her as well. Julie even calls Eliza's cell phone knowing that there was no way she was going to answer. Now, a day later, Brittany sends her mother a text message saying that she loves her and she's sorry and goodbye. She then walks into the police station to turn herself in. By this stage, Julie had already headed back to Perth and she rung to tell Brittany that she was about to walk into the city police station as well. And at almost the exact same time, the two girls confessed to murdering their friend.
Did anything in your research say, like, what prompted them to turn themselves in? Because that's, you don't hear that a lot. In cases like this, like the, you know, kids try to hide, they try to deny it. Like that's actually really unexpected.
It never did say in the research and I couldn't find it in the court transcripts. Possibly the guilt got hold of them. Then in May of 2007, Brittany and Julie were sentenced to life imprisonment. The judge said in sentencing that he could not find any reasonable explanation to why they did what they did, and neither could the experts who examined and spoke to the two girls. They will be eligible for parole in 2022. But even now in prison, the two girls aren't separated due to the setup of the juvenile prison. So even though the codependent relationship was a big part of what was deemed the reason they murdered their friend, this toxic relationship continues. I read an interview with Brittany's mother and she says that Brittany always responds with we, like we're going to do this, we did that, instead of me or I. And according to reports, both still express or display a lack of remorse over what happened. They talk about killing with no emotion at all. I really do hope these girls are receiving some sort of psychiatric treatment in prison because there does seem to be some significant mental health issues that desperately need to be addressed before parole can even be considered. And you are silent. You are shocked.
I'm curious about, because here, well, certainly at least in Pennsylvania, but I think in a large part of the United States, when somebody is sentenced to life in prison, there is no possibility for parole.
Okay.
I'm always curious when I hear you talk about cases from Australia where somebody might have gotten life in prison, but there's still eligibility to be considered for parole. Like, is there a parole board or a group of prison officials who re-examine the case?
Life imprisonment in Australia is 25 years. And you only need to serve 2/3 of that.
They're only serving like 15-ish to 20,
exactly.
To 18 years. Okay.
So we're looking at them being around my age when they're released. So early 30s. which is crazy considering they took someone's life in the very cold-blooded way.
And to your point, there was no provocation, and not that provocation would have justified it, but still, there was nothing that that girl did that in any way would have angered or enraged them. It was like, you know, I'm bored, we're out of drugs, let's kill her.
I mean, we can tell that Brittany had no regard to life by killing that kitten. You had Julie's jealousy over Brittany and Eliza's relationship. I think all of that combined, it wasn't the best relationship, best friendship.
Well, it's so much of what you talked about with their upbringing. I'd found something online that I sent to you the other day. It was just some information about kids who kill. And one of the things that the presentation talked about was difficulties and challenges in a young person's home life. Now, that doesn't mean that every kid who has a rough upbringing is going to go out and kill somebody. But, you know, experts and psychologists do find that in many children who kill, there are some patterns. Issues with their upbringing, like drug abuse in the home or no parental supervision, physical abuse in the home. There's patterns there for sure. And it sounds like at least two, if not all three of these young ladies kind of fit into that same scope of issues.
But going back to what you said about life imprisonment, the chance of no parole is very rarely sentenced here. You can count on one hand the amount of people that have that stamped on their file, never to be released.
It's so different. And Pennsylvania is probably the worst. It's one of the worst states in the country for we have the highest number of lady lifers. We have the highest number of juvenile lifers. We have the second highest number of lifers in general. So PA, man, they don't cut you any slack. It's a tough state. It's a really tough state. That's a sad story, Allie.
It is. It is. And as I said, there's a lot of parallels to the Slender Man stabbings that happened over in the US.
Did you watch the documentary on Slender Man?
I haven't watched that yet, no.
It's good. It's a good one.
Our Netflix is a bit questionable. We don't get that much on there.
Well, and then I get upset because our Netflix doesn't release BBC shows as early as they come out in Britain. Ah. And so I'm always a year behind on things I want to watch from the BBC. And yeah, we picked Kids Who Kill as a, you know, belated Mother's Day episode. So
I keep doing this to you. When you're on our show, I gave you a horrible story and I give you another one now.
Oh, I got a horrible story coming up. So... But, you know, I think that's part of why I do some true crime episodes and obviously why you and Charlie do true crime. It's important to listen to stories like this, you know, one, so you can help keep the memory of the victim alive and to educate people and consider why do these things happen? And as a society, what could or should we do differently, especially with our kids, to try to prevent things like this from happening?
And I agree with you with that. When I read people say that true crime podcasts is just for entertainment, I don't agree with that because it is about education and awareness and giving the victim a voice that they may not have had otherwise.
All right, before we get into my Kids Who Kill story from Philadelphia, we are going to take a quick Pattern Family break. If you don't know what a Pattern Family break is, it's when we play some promos of shows that we love. Some might be true crime, some are entertainment, because my podcast interests go all over the map. And we will be right back. This is the entertainment portion. Allie and I are going to sing.
What is the Pattern Family?
Hey guys, it's Rad Dad Chad,
Jay Mills,
and Lil Man
from the Full of Fiber podcast.
Hey y'all, it's Juliette Miranda from the Unwritable Rant podcast.
Hey, this is Bro from the World of Row podcast.
This is Cyanide from the Little Geek Lost podcast.
Hey, this is Rick from Ice and the Face.
This is Nick from the Epic Film Guys podcast.
This is Greg from the Sports Dance podcast.
This is Knock from the Geek Over podcast.
This is Gareth from the Open All Powers podcast.
This is Paul from the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast.
This is Adam from Everyone Has a Podcast.
Hey, we're Josh and David from the Scotch and Flicks podcast.
This is Matthew McDonough from the Passersby podcast.
This is Eric Mocker from the Mockers podcast.
We are you, podcasters coming together in a community to help one another grow. So follow us on Twitter at Pattern Family and use the hashtag Pattern Family in your tweets and retweet other people who do the same. Pattern Family, where great podcasts come home.
Hi, this is Christy Lee of the Canadian True Crime Podcast. Join me for a journey through many of the most heinous and shocking crimes in recent Canadian history, starting with Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka. You can find me on your favorite podcast app, Facebook or Twitter. Just search for Canadian True Crime. Thanks to Twisted Philly for having me on the show.
And we're back. When I talked to Allie this week about the story that I was going to share, I said it was maddening, and it's definitely sad for sure, and it's heartbreaking, and it also pisses me the fuck off. This story takes place in a section of Philadelphia called Fishtown. Allie, any comments Fishtown. About a town name? Yeah, it's called Fishtown. I'm going to throw a little history in because I always want to include history whenever I can. So the locals know exactly where this section of Philadelphia lies, but not everyone may know why it's called Fishtown. It got its name back in the 1800s when German immigrants bought fishing rights along the Delaware River. And the Delaware runs through Philadelphia between Jersey and the Philadelphia city limits. It's an area that was known for shad fishing. Shad fishing. It was an area known for shad fishing.
What's shad fishing?
Well, I had no idea what shad was, even though I eat like a ton of fish on a very frequent basis. And even though it's totally irrelevant to the story, I had to find out. Shad are a type of herring, and they're considered forager fishes. And apparently they're fun for sport fishing because they jump out of the water.
Oh, cool.
I had no idea we even had these outside of Philadelphia. So Fishtown is known as kind of a tough but really hardworking community. It's a pretty blue-collar community, and it's gone through a lot of ups and downs in the last 50 years. But today, it's a pretty cool part of the city. And a little over 10 years ago, Fishtown became infamous throughout the country because of the murder of a kid named Jason Sweeney. So Jason was born in 1986. His parents weren't married, and they split up before Jason was born. Interestingly enough, he never knew his birth mother because he lived his entire life with his father. So his bio mom split and left the baby with his dad, which isn't often what you hear in stories where, you know, parents split up. It's often the child's left with the mom. And just a couple of months after Jason was born, his dad married a woman named Dawn. So he was really never without a mom. She raised him practically from birth. And, you know, his family described...
So she was his mom then.
Yeah, she was his mom. I shouldn't even be talking about his bio mom. He's the kind of kid that his parents say really looked for the good in everyone. He tried to find something positive about everybody. His sister, Melissa, described him as a goofball. And to me, you know, I wouldn't call him a typical kid growing up in the 80s because... while a lot of kids, especially in this part of the city, were starting to mess around with drugs and getting into trouble really for no other reason than because they were bored, Jason was a really good kid. He had a good head on his shoulders. He didn't really like school. So before he started his junior year in high school, he dropped out and he went to work in construction with his dad. His dad had his own construction business and he loved working construction and he was really good at it.
Oh, cool.
And so working in construction, you know, helped him physically, and he was thinking about joining the Navy when he was old enough. So, you know, being healthy, being physically fit, working with his hands, he thought that would be something good that would really help him get into the Navy when he was a little bit older.
Which would use those skills in the Navy.
So, you know, unlike a lot of his friends or his, you know, kids that he used to be friends with, Jason was really, he was really focused on making something of his life and setting a plan for himself. So he and his dad worked at a construction site that, for folks listening who know Philly, it was at the corner of 2nd and Spring Garden Street. And what was nice about that site was, even though he dropped out of school, he would see a lot of his friends there because there was a bus stop to school right near the construction site. And it gave him a chance to hang out. He would buy his friends coffee before they would head to school. What 16-year-old kid buys his friends coffee in the morning before school?
Be friends with him.
When I was 16, I can assure you that none of my friends were making offers to buy me coffee before school.
I think any of my 16-year-old friends were drinking coffee.
It was something small that Jason would do to make people smile. He was a generous kid. He was just a good dude. Here's the thing about those coffee runs. So Jason, unlike a lot of his friends, had money because he was working full time. He was making about $250 a week. Back in 2003, that was about like the equivalent of $600.
And he's dating, so that's a massive amount of money.
It's a lot of money. He was doing better, not just than a lot of his peers, but he was even doing better than some of the adults in his neighborhood. So when Jason was little, he had a really good friend, a kid named Eddie Batzig. They were inseparable when they were young, when they were in elementary school. And we all had that friend, a super, super, very, very, very bestest best friend. We were kind of stupid because at that age, you could only ever envision that person being your friend for the rest of your life. I know who that person was for me. I'm sure you probably know who that person was for you when you
were
little.
I'm still friends with that person.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. So I am too. She lives in California now, and we lost touch off and on for a while, reconnected
here.
Through social media. And sometimes that happens, right? You get to the higher grades and your circle of friends shift. Maybe you're not connected anymore. But for Jason Sweeney, that kid was Eddie Batzig. In August 2002, Eddie and Jason took a trip to Florida for Jason's 16th birthday. They visited his grandparents, and that was actually really the last time that Jason and his friend Eddie hung out together. They'd already started drifting, and a big reason why they started drifting is because some of the kids that Eddie was starting to hang out with. They were kids that Jason's parents told him to stay away from. They were kids who were troublemakers. They would do stupid shit just for the sake of doing stupid shit. They would steal. They would skip school. They were doing drugs. They were kids like two guys named Dominic and Nicholas Coya, who were brothers. So Jason's old friend Eddie was spending a lot of time with the Coya brothers and a lot less time with Jason. And it was so much so that even Jason's parents noticed and commented on it. Now, unlike some kids who might get upset by that, Jason just kind of took it in stride. He had his dreams, he had his plan, and that's what he was focused on. And besides all of those great things going on in his life, he had just met a girl that he was falling for. It was a 15-year-old girl named Justina Morley. Now, when I look at pictures of Justina Morley from 2003, the first word that comes to my mind is emo. She's pretty. She's very pretty, and she's very pale. She has very long, dark, dark hair parted in the middle. In the picture I sent Allie, she's not wearing any makeup. It's her mugshot. And she went to Catholic school. She went to a place named the Holy Name of Jesus School. Now, that's a pretty religious name of a school. And she was 15. Jason met her around the neighborhood, and they were instantly taken with each other. That summer, he had only known Justina for a few weeks, but he felt strongly enough about her that he talked to his mother about her. He told his mom, "I met this really great girl, and she's really sweet, and I think you're going to really like her. I want to bring her home to meet you and dad." Again, I think that just shows the kind of young man that Jason Sweeney was, because not a lot of 16-year-old boys would be talking to their mom about a girl they just met and wanting to bring her home.
He was living as an adult, so I think he was very mature.
His parents, Don and Paul Sweeney, did eventually meet Justina, but it wasn't in the way that Jason ever envisioned. So the next day was Friday, May 30th. Jason went to work, and it was payday. So he had 2 weeks' worth of construction pay on him. He had $500. And then he went out after work. He didn't give his parents specifics about where he was going. You know, like you said, he was a mature kid. They weren't policing him. He said there might be a party at somebody's house that he would want to hit up. When his parents woke up the next morning, Jason wasn't home. Because he was such a good kid, they called the police and they filed a missing persons report. The nice thing about this case, and we don't hear this often, is that when a teenager is reported missing, police will often assume initially that it was a runaway. That was not the case with Jason. They didn't assume he was a runaway. They immediately started the process of identifying Jason as a missing person. After they called the police, the word started to spread around the neighborhood in Fishtown. Jason's good friend, Eddie Batzig, showed up at his parents' house with his friend, Nick Coya. They were really concerned. They were concerned about Jason. They were concerned about his well-being. They were telling Jason's parents, "I don't know what could have happened to him. I don't know what anybody would have done to him." And of course, Jason's parents wanted to know, "Hey, he said he might have gone to a party last night. Did you guys happen to go? Yes. Did you see him?" They said they did. Jason's parents asked them to put together a list of everyone that they saw at the party. While this is happening, two kids are walking through a very densely wooded area around the Delaware River. It's a place called the Trails. Some people take their dogs walking there. Some people go there to get high. It's really unpopulated, and it's kind of a secretive place. Two teenage boys are running the trails, and they stumble across remains. And at first, they can't tell what the remains are. And as they get closer, they realize the remains are a body. The police officer that was one of the first folks on the scene, and he was part of the investigative team that went out to the trails, his name was Michael Williford. He actually had to film the crime scene. I watched an interview with him that was filmed just about a year or two ago, and you could see that this crime scene still stayed with him. It still affects him. They found a body. It was the body of a man. There were no shoes. There were no pants. The man's heels had carved grooves into the dirt, and his hands were filled with dirt and grass because he had tried to either claw or crawl away from whatever was happening to him. And the horrible part, Allie, was the police couldn't tell if he was young or old because his face had been bludgeoned so severely it was completely unrecognizable. His teeth had been knocked out of his mouth, and they were lying a few feet away on the ground. Right at the crime scene, the police found a huge rock that was covered with blood and a hatchet that had blood and hair in it. And there was a wallet laying nearby, but the wallet was empty. There was no money. There was no ID. Police couldn't identify who this person was. They had some suspicions that it could be Jason Sweeney, but they didn't know who it was at that time. So Jason had been murdered sometime between Friday night when he finished work and Saturday morning when his body was found. They called his parents and said that they'd found a body. Wasn't sure if it was Jason, but they wanted his parents to come down to the police station and see if they could identify it.
So wait, they had to look at this body, but they had to see their son with his face bashed in.
None of the research said whether or not they actually saw his head, but his mom, Dawn Sweeney, said that she couldn't. I think they must have, because she said she couldn't identify him. She couldn't tell it was him by his face.
Oh, fuck me. That's horrible.
When the body was released to the medical examiner, he had to use dental records. That was the only thing he could use to identify that this was indeed Jason Sweeney. Within a couple of days, because, you know, Fishtown is a really small, tight-knit community. It's part of Philadelphia, but within Philadelphia, there's so many small neighborhoods and people talk. I mean, literally that day, the police were getting tips from teenagers in the neighborhoods, people who had heard Dominic Coya talk about wanting money. They knew that they were fooling around with drugs. They knew that they were kind of messed up kids. And they'd actually heard Dominic over the course of the last month or so talk about how he wanted to kill somebody. He wanted to know what it would be like to kill someone. So within days, the Philadelphia police had four people in custody for Jason's murder. It was his childhood friend, Eddie Batzig. It was the two brothers that Eddie hung out with, Dominic and Nick Coya. And it was Jason's girlfriend, Justina Morley.
How did she get all involved in this?
Well, I'm going to tell you that.
Thank you.
Their original plan wasn't a murder in the woods. Dominic and Nick and Eddie told Justina to convince Jason to have a party, to take a day off of work, throw a party at the house. And Justina was going to take him up to his bedroom with a promise of sex. Once she got him away in the bedroom, the boys would come out, they would kill Jason, and then they would rob the safe that was in Jason's parents' house because with his dad's construction business, they did rather well for themselves.
Yes.
And if by some chance Jason's parents came home when this was happening, then the boys would kill them too. The problem with all this was Jason was a good kid and he didn't want to take a day off of work. He didn't want to skip work so his friends could come over and drink.
No, he wouldn't want to let his dad down.
Exactly. So the plan to kill him in his house had to be changed. Justina met up with Jason after work on Friday, May 30th. And she said, let's go to the trails. Nobody will be around to bother us. It'll be quiet. It'll be romantic. She promised Jason that she wanted to have sex with him. And, you know, what 16-year-old kid is going to turn that down?
Okay.
So once they got to the woods, Justina says, I'm going to take my pants off. You take your pants off. Let's get down to business. And the three boys were hiding in the bushes. The boys were all charged with first-degree murder. They brutally and savagely beat Jason Sweeney to death for money. For $500 that he busted his ass earning, working every day with his dad doing construction. And it was only 2 days after Jason's body was found that these kids were all before a judge in a preliminary hearing. That's how fast the Philadelphia police moved on this. The boys were charged with first-degree murder, and in the state of Pennsylvania, first-degree murder means you can get the death penalty.
Yes.
The whole city was waiting to see what the district attorney would do, and the district attorney is somebody who's very familiar to all of our listeners and everybody in Philadelphia. At the time, the DA was a woman named Lynn Abraham, who is known for being really tough on crime. She's the woman that sentenced Lois Ficarson to life in prison, even though Lois didn't kill anyone.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, Lynn did not go for the death penalty in these cases, and the city was shocked. And Justina Morley, well, because she was only 15, there's no way the death penalty would have applied to her because she was too young.
Yeah.
Jason Sweeney's murder trial began in February of 2005, and the details that came out about his murder were absolutely horrific. So many of those details came directly from Justina Morley. She was testifying for the prosecution, and that was part of a deal that was offered to her by the prosecutor and the ADA, that they would not go after her for first-degree murder. They would charge her with third-degree murder if she would agree to testify for the prosecution and plead guilty and forego a trial to save everyone the grief of having to prove her guilt. And she agreed. And I really have to say something here about Jason's parents, because I can see how Dawn and Paul Sweeney might have fought something like that, but they didn't, because I think they knew that her testimony would really help seal the fate of the boys who murdered their son. And maybe she didn't actually participate in killing Jason, but she is the one who lured him there, and she knew exactly what was going to happen to him once she got him to the trails.
Exactly. Without her doing that, it never would have happened.
Right. He never would have gone to the trails if Justina hadn't invited him to go there.
Well, it may not, but...
Yeah, they could have gotten him at some point, but he wouldn't have been there unless it was because of her. When all of the information about how Jason Sweeney died came out in the trial, the judge said it was like something out of the dark ages. And Judy Conroy, who was the Philadelphia Assistant District Attorney, I know, Allie, that name probably doesn't mean much to you, but there's folks in Philly that definitely remember her name. She was quoted as saying, "The brutality of this case is beyond the spoken word. The extent of his injuries and the amount of force necessary to inflict those injuries is unspeakable." And what she means by that is there are 29 bones in the human head and face. 28 of those bones were broken in Jason Sweeney's head and face. One was left unbroken. And I'm not going to take you through every blow that he suffered, but I do want to tell you the very first blow was swung by his childhood best friend, Eddie Bratzig. He was beat with a rock and a hatchet and a hammer. All but the hammer were found at the crime scene.
I just don't understand the overkill. You kill him for money, but why the overkill? It's next level.
And they didn't even have to kill him. I mean, they could have just jumped him and robbed him. They didn't, exactly as you said, Ellie.
Just rob him.
They didn't have to take it to this level. They didn't have to kill him and demonstrate such brutality.
Exactly.
When they started hitting Jason, he begged for his life. He begged them to stop. And they jumped on him before he went unconscious. He looked at Justina Morley and said, "You set me up." The sick thing is, as bad as the murder was, when they were done, they had a group hug. Dominic Coya, who was the oldest of the group, took Jason's wallet, grabbed the money out, took the ID, and tossed the wallet on the ground beside him. They killed him for money for weed and Xanax and money to party, and Jason's parents really felt they did this because they were jealous. These kids were going nowhere. Yeah, they had horrible home lives, but not everybody that comes from a horrible home life turns into a killer. And Jason was someone who was really setting a future for himself. He was on a path. They didn't like it. You know, they didn't want to look at him as a kid who was going to get out of Fishtown and make something of himself. But this is what also reminds me about so much of the story that you told, because of the home life that some of these kids had.
Yeah.
There was drug abuse, alcohol abuse, abandonment by the part of their parents.
Yeah.
So a lot of similarities between the Coya brothers and the girls in your story. I feel like those kids looked at Jason Sweeney and thought, "Who the hell do you think you are?" Almost like they thought he was too big for his britches. "You're just like us. You're just a kid from Fishtown." And that's why I think it was overkill, like you mentioned earlier, that these kids were angry at him. I think they were angry for the life that he had that they couldn't.
Which is a cop-out. They could do exactly what he did.
Of course they could.
It's a cop-out.
They're blaming their circumstances when they had an opportunity to make different choices.
Exactly.
During her testimony, Justina Morley was required to read from a mountain of letters that she wrote the defendants while they were all incarcerated. And so here's the really fucked up part about this. Before Jason's murder, she had sex with both Eddie Bratzig and Nick Coya. Then she decided Dominic Coya was the one that she really wanted. So she was going to have sex with him too, but she wanted to get pregnant by both of the brothers. She wanted to have both Nick and Dominic impregnate her, and then she could have both their babies and raise the babies once she got out of jail. This really, I think, shows me what her 15-year-old brain was like. It makes me wonder if at the time she truly understood the depth and implications of what she was doing. And then I think about the organization, the Fight for Lifers, that I learned about when I was developing the episodes about Lois F. Carson, the Good Doctor series. And one of the programs they have is advocating for juvenile lifers. And, you know, the issue of whether or not juvenile lifers really understand what it was that they did that wound up getting them life in prison. This was her uninformed, uneducated 15-year-old brain. Like, here's Justina Morley thinking she can have sex with two different boys and have two different babies. That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works. So I'm not saying she didn't know what she was doing when she led Jason into the woods. She did. She knew that those boys were going to jump him, and they told her they wanted to kill him. I'm questioning whether or not at 15, she fully understood the depth of what all of that meant and the role that she played in making that happen. Allie, I want to take a minute and play for you an excerpt from some of the letters that she had to read during her testimony.
I'm a cold-blooded fucking death-worshipping bitch who survives by feeding off the weak and lonely. I like the movies about Hannibal, and I always wanted to live off of human flesh. If I get out, I'm getting fangs put in permanently. I remember like 2 years ago, I tried to sharpen my teeth with a metal filer.
See, to me, that just sounds like just some stupid kid stuff.
I totally agree. It sounds like she's saying something for the sake of being shocking because she thinks that she'll fit in better with older boys.
That's not having really any real understanding or concept of reality.
Justina's testimony had a lot to do with the convictions of Eddie Bratzig and both Nick and Dominic Coya. But both Eddie Bratzig and Dominic Coya confessed. When Eddie was being interrogated, police asked him, "How hard did you have to swing that hatchet to make such a devastating blow?" And Eddie said, "I swung it as hard as I could." And the police asked him, "But you were his friend. Did you know that Dominic and Nick were going to kill him?" And he said, "Yeah, I knew. That's what we were planning on doing." And then when the police were questioning Dominic, one of the first things they asked him was, "Were you high? Were you drunk? I was as sober then as I am right now." The other thing about Dominic was he sort of fashioned himself a young Charles Manson. The day of Jason's murder, he and his brother and Eddie and Justina listened to Helter Skelter 42 times. He wanted to try to live up to what Charles Manson did. Dominic's remark about everybody being sober, again, reminds me of the story you told.
Yes, yeah.
The girls who had been partying the night before, but the day of the murder, they were not high, they hadn't been using drugs, so they were all well within their right mind.
They knew what they were doing, yeah.
The three boys were all found guilty of first-degree murder. At their sentencing hearing, they each received life in prison plus 22 and a half to 45 years. And it always shocks and surprises me when the state of Pennsylvania does that, because how can you serve more?
More than life.
Right. How can you serve more than life in prison? Jason's parents were at the sentencing hearing. Actually, Paul and Dawn Sweeney were at every single court appointment, event, pretrial, motion, everything that had anything at all to do with Jason's case. They had to sit through all of the testimony. They had to watch a video of the crime scene.
Which you can imagine them hearing all of this. How do you just get through the day?
I don't know, Allie. I don't know how they did it. I give these people so much credit. They have so much strength and courage. It's unbelievable. Something that blew me away about the sentencing hearing was Jason Sweeney's sister, Melissa. So she spoke at the sentencing hearing, and she said she does not hold any animosity or resentment against the people who killed him. Because if she did that...
Well, they win, don't they?
Exactly. They would win. And she said that it would get in the way of celebrating the things in life that Jason will never be able to experience, like falling in love and getting married, having children and growing old with somebody. And I don't know what it takes to have that level of forgiveness in your heart for people like this, for someone who stole a loved one from you. Jason's father was not as forgiving as Melissa. He stood in the courtroom and he screamed at Jason's killers.
"Here's how it's gonna work. Every single night when you close your eyes, you're gonna see mine looking back at you. Look at me, Eddie! Look at me, Dominic! You think you have evil in your eyes? You're going to see mine every single night when you close yours. I'll come down here and I'll crack you. My son's dead. They're still alive and my fucking son's dead.
Jason's father says all that. Dominic Coya, this fucking punk, turns around and says to the judge, "Well, I never thought I had evil eyes, but I'm cool, man."
Fucking idiot.
And Jason's father lost it, as you heard at the end of that clip, and he had to be removed from the courtroom by sheriff's deputies.
God, I hope I'd never be in that situation. Like, please God, no, but you need a whole army to hold me back.
Yeah, my ass would have gotten removed too, because I'd be going over an attorney's table to get to that little prick. You'd think that this was the end of the story, but it's not. There's just a little more. In 2012, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania passed a law stating that life sentences for juvenile offenders was a form of cruel and unusual punishment, and all juveniles serving life sentences needed to have their cases reconsidered, and in some cases, their sentencing would need to be resentenced. Now, Dominic Coya wasn't eligible for resentencing because he was 17 at the time of the murder, but his brother Nick was because he was only 16. So for 2 days in February of 2015, Dawn and Paul Sweeney were back at court at Nick Coya's resentencing hearing, and the judge resentenced him to life in prison.
Good.
The judge said there were no circumstances that in any way indicated his life sentence should be vacated or changed. He planned the murder, he carried out the murder, and he'd done nothing in his time in jail since then to really demonstrate any level of remorse whatsoever. And Allie, you mentioned one of the young ladies in your story was going to be eligible for parole in 2022.
Yes, that's correct. To be granted parole, though, she would have to show remorse. And
so that's very similar here. Justina Morley will be eligible for parole for the first time in 2020. She was sentenced to between 17 and a half to 35 years. So 2020 will be the first eligibility or parole hearing that she could have. And just like you said, she too would have to demonstrate remorse. And nothing in my research indicated that that's the case. I did find some articles about the resentencing hearing where she was mentioned, and the reporter said that she's definitely indicated that she regrets what happened. My hope, though, is because she's in a facility called Cambridge Springs, where there's a group of lady lifers who work with women who are incarcerated but are eligible for parole at some point, that she's getting help from that group of women. They teach other inmates how to live differently on the outside and how to take accountability for what they've done and to be positively contributing members of society.
Because her situation's the same as my girl's, like, even though they're eligible in 2022, and less dramatically since the last interview with Brittany's mother, I can't see them being granted parole. They would be in an adult prison now. Hopefully they've been separated. Hopefully that will help their recovery from whatever is going on, but yeah, I can't see it happening.
These were some fucking heavy stories. Shit, I need a drink. But it's Saturday morning and I don't have any champagne in the house. And in my opinion, champagne is the only true alcoholic breakfast drink. Just throw some OJ in there and you got a mimosa.
Hey, it's 1:45 in the morning here.
Holy shit. You got to get to sleep, girl. We better wrap this up. What I realized through doing episodes like this is there are troubled children everywhere. There are kids trying to figure out life, trying to figure out what they want to do with their life, trying to deal with whatever their home life and other situations are. And I guess what Allie and I are trying to say is, please don't raise murdering assholes. We need to be raising kids like Jason Sweeney.
The world needs more Jason Sweeneys, and I'm literally heartbroken that he ended like that. That's horrible.
It is horrible. It's unbelievably sad. When I first started working on this case, I knew about it. I knew about it from the news in Philly, and it was maddening and it pissed me off. But the more research I did, it was just so sad. And what's really twisted is we have a case very similar to Jason's that happened just a few years after he was murdered. A young girl named Christina Hamm, who was lured away to a desolate wooded area by people she thought were her friends, and her dead body was found on a riverbank, just in a different part of the city. And I'm not going to tell that story because we are already too fucking sad right now. Allie. This is the end of Twisted Sight for today. I don't want to say goodbye.
I know, it's been fun. Let's go for another hour.
Allie and I are going to be meeting face-to-face, although we do see each other face-to-face.
I did my hair and makeup for you, just saying.
Oh my God, girl, you always look gorgeous.
Please, I know.
As you can see, I did not do my hair for you. My hair looks like a rat's nest this morning.
You look gorgeous, don't lie.
Thank you, my dear. Okay, so in just a little over 2.5 weeks, Allie and I will be traveling to Indianapolis for a very special event.
Oh, shit. It's going to be crazy.
In a little over 2.5 weeks, Allie is going to be flying around the world.
22 hours.
Did you say 22 hours? Bitch, that's crazy. I don't know if I could do that. I would have to take some serious sleep aids and ass out for 22 hours.
Dude, I will be.
Allie is flying around the world to go to CrimeCon on June 9th and 10th. And if you could see her face right now, her smile could light up the entire world. We are all so excited about this event, partly because of the great activities and panels that are set up, but also because we get to meet our friends. Yay! Before we sign off, I have a couple of very special thank yous. As always, thank you to Emmy Serra for the music you hear in this and every episode. You can find out more about Emmy on her website at emmyserra.com, and you can download her music on iTunes. Thank you also to Kelly from the Murder Dictionary podcast for the voiceover of Justina's letters. And thank you to Jeremy Collins from the Podcast We Listen To podcast and for the voiceover of Paul Sweeney, Jason Sweeney's father. You can find the Murder Dictionary podcast on Twitter at @M_D_podcast. And you can find Podcasts We Listen To on Twitter at @PWLT Podcast. You can listen to both of these shows on iTunes and really any podcast app. Allie, since you are our special guest, would you like to say goodbye, Twisted Philly style?
Ciao for now, listeners.